There's coffee there.
Huh?
There's coffee there.
Oh, yeah. I started drinking an instant cup when I first got up, but yeah.
I put an automatic timer, so it's, by 5:15 it's done.
Perfect.
Well, Lily's going to California today.
Something happening in California?
Yes. Always, right?
Always.
That's where it's happening, California.
Her daughter.
Getting married.
Oh. They're getting married. None of her children are married. They're having such a good time, why should they get married?
Sympathize with our fellow. They get married.
Another one bites the dust.
Yeah, he said it to her. My wife is dying next to me. And she's also laughing.
July 1967. Letters to the editor, Mountain Path. Who am I in Zen? This is a long letter, but I think it's more like an article. Occurring in Philip Capillo's book, The Three Pillars of Zen. Now, you know, his wife was a devotee, Philip Capillo, the Rochester Zen Center, where David and Anna met.
Oh, yes.
David was a priest there, David Clagan, the psychiatrist.
At the Zen Center where?
Rochester, New York.
Right in Rochester.
Yeah,
wow.
It's still there. Still they have it up there. And with Capillo, he started it, and his wife had come. I met his wife came to 6th Street, maybe in the 70s. And you see, around this time, around 1970, she went visited Ramana Ashram. She named her daughter Ramana. And his wife was a devotee monk.
Oh, daughter's called Ramana?
Philip Kepler's wife. So this is Sarah Farron.
That's a beautiful girl's name, don't you think about
what?
It, Ramana. Yeah. But it would be Ramani, right?
No, I think Ramana. I saw the
actually, picture.
Actually,
Ramani is also a guy's name in India.
Oh.
Ramani.
Ramani and Ramana are all guys' names in India. I know the knees actually are usually girls, right? Lakshmi and Saraswati.
Yeah.
And so Ramani is all the boy's name.
And Ramana a girl?
Ramana is definitely a boy's name.
Occurring in Philip Capillo's book, The Three Pillars of Zen, reviewed in The Mountain Path in October 1966, is an episode which is of far more than routine relevance and interest for those doing sadhana of Atma Vichara as taught by Ramana Maharshi, and it seemed worthwhile giving an outline of it for the benefit of those who may not have had a chance to read the book. It appears in the section on Dolkasan, interviews between the Roshi and students, starts on page 136 and concerns the first efforts of a 33-year-old Westerner to practice self-inquiry, her day-by-day reports to the Roshi, and his consequent guidance and advice. The student had been practicing Zazen for 2 years previous to her present participation in the Sesshin of the Yasutani Roshi, principally on the Koan Mu, but without any apparent success.
In fact, Koan
what?
The Koan, they repeat something. Mu must have some meaning, I'm not sure what. In fact, she admits to finding it distasteful. The Roshi tells her that concentration on Mu is the same as inquiry into one's essential being, but suggests that she might find a slightly different approach, more absorbing, such as investigating what am I or who am I. She agrees that the last would be more meaningful for her, and so embarks upon this koan for the remainder of the session.
Moo is like a backwards om.
What very quickly becomes apparent to the reader, and rather surprising to one who has himself been inquiring in this way for quite a while, is how extraordinarily difficult, boring, and fruitless the students find the practice, as can be seen from the following quotation picked at random from her reports. When I question myself, who am I? I say to myself, I am bones, I am blood, I am skin. Where do I go from there? In other words, she cannot disassociate herself from the body. Quote, but I don't know what it is that is asking, who am I? And not knowing this, or who it is that is being asked, how can I find who am I? Unquote. Unquote. I have come to the conclusion that I am this body, that is these eyes, these legs, and so forth. At the same time, I realize that these organs do not exist independently. Unquote. But the possibilities of this last statement are dimmed when she goes on to say that her eyes need objects to perceive in order to perform the act of seeing, and that therefore she must be part of the universe. No hint is given of knowledge of the being which makes the very act of seeing possible. Attention is centered on eyeball, an external object. Quote, last time you said, I was not my mind and not my body. I don't understand. If I am neither of these, nor a combination of them, what am I? Unquote. It is so difficult that she must address this question to her master rather than to herself. And then, and then fear, quote, I have always thought of myself as a mind and a body. It frightens me to think differently, unquote. Yasutani Roshi listens with infinite patience, and his replies cannot fail to arouse a deep response from devotees of Ramana Maharshi. So similar are they in character to the answers given by Bhagavan, when questioned by seekers, that they could easily be mistaken for his own words. A few of the examples will illustrate this. Quote, remember, you are neither your body nor your mind, and you are not your mind added to your body. Then what are you? If you would grasp the real you, and not merely a figment, you must constantly ask yourself, who am I? With absolute devotion. If you persistently question yourself, who am I? With devotion and zeal, that is to say, moved by a genuine desire for self-knowledge, you are bound to realize the nature of mind. So long as you think of yourself as this small body, you will feel restless and discontented. But when through enlightenment you actually experience the universe as identical with yourself, you will attain lasting peace. Man is forever seeking and grasping why. Why? He grasps for the world because intuitively he longs to be rejoined with that from which he has been estranged through delusion. The fact is that in their essential nature, all sentient beings transcend their body and their mind, which are not two but one. The failure of human beings to perceive this fundamental truth is the cause of all their suffering. The question, who am I, precipitates you into an awareness of your fundamental solidarity with the universe. The answer can only come out of persistent questioning with an intense yearning to know. The question, who am I, brings you to the radiant core of your being. But in spite of these wonderfully illumined words of guidance, the account ends as the session draws to a close, with the student in the same perplexed and confused state of mind, and one is left pondering over why, for some seekers, it is so difficult as to be almost impossible to recognize that, in essence, they are most definitely not a body, despite all apparent evidence to the contrary, and that if once this can be grasped and actually seen, the keys to the paradise garden is there for everyone. And there's no comment from the editor.
That's the end of the article?
It's not an article, actually, it's just a letter. Now we're on April 1967.
So she just wasn't right. She was all in her mind.
It was someone's company, but Philip Keplow.
Those people still alive?
I don't think so. No, Philip Keplow and his wife, I think they're both gone. But you can see her picture in the mountain path. I forget what year, but it's... And her daughter also. There's a picture there.
Ramana.
And I remember they came to the ashram in Manhattan one time. Her and
I
her
wonder
daughter.
What happened to Ramana.
Must be around. Younger than us. Predestination. Editorial. The same must be said about predestination that I said in a previous editorial about reincarnation. That the question can be discussed only from the point of view of ignorance. Because from the point of view of knowledge, there is no one to be predestined. I have illustrated this elsewhere. Quote, it is as though a group of people who had never heard of radio were to stand around a wireless van arguing whether the man in the van has to sing what the transmitting station tells him to, or whether he can change parts of the songs. The answer is that there is no man in the van, and therefore the question does not arise. Similarly, the answer to the question whether the ego has free will or not is that there is no ego, and therefore the question does not arise. Unquote. The problem that philosophers and theologians set themselves is unreal, being based on the false assumption of an ego to be predestined. In addition, it is insoluble, because the two alternatives are quite irreconcilable. If anything exists already in the divine foreknowledge of an omniscient God, then it cannot be changed by man's free will. If not, then God does not know what is going to happen and is not omniscient. If it is a cinema, the whole story is already in the film. What has not yet been shown on the screen, as well as what has been, even though the audience did not know what is coming, if it is an impromptu television show, the operator also does not know what will come next. The compromise that some theologians have found of suggesting that God has only predetermined important matters and left the unimportant for men to fill in is too unintelligent and anthropomorphic to merit refutation. In any case, who decides what is important and on what scale of values? A young man is invited to the capital to be interviewed for a job abroad in a foreign service and decides to go. Obviously, an important decision, since it will change his cultural and social environment. The person he marries, the children he fathers, the whole course of his life. On his way to the air office to book a seat on a plane, he meets a friend who invites him to go to the capital in his car with him and accepts an unimportant decision. which are suppositions Grandfather God might well leave to the young man to decide for himself. However, he does not get the job, so the important decision turns out to have been unimportant. But the plane he was to travel by crashes, and all the occupants are killed. So the unimportant decision gives him 30 or 40 more years of life, and is vitally important, not only to him, but to the woman he is going to marry, the children he will father, their future wives and children and business partners. In fact, to an unending succession of people, generation after generation, the whole theory is too absurd for discussion. People cling to such absurdity because there is nothing a man finds more difficult than to face up to the truth of anatta, no ego. Even those who accept it theoretically all too often find some way of avoiding its implications in fact. Perhaps this is partly because people imagine that the alternative to ego would be mere nothingness. And yet life itself proves that this is not so, since everyone lives and experiences despite anatta. The only question is who or what lives and experiences. Actually, the alternative to the illusion of an ego is the reality of inexhaustible radiant being. So long as the appearance of an ego remains, so long does the appearance of free will. In fact, they are mutually dependent. Therefore, the Maharshi said, free will exists together with the individuality. As long as the individuality lasts, so long is there free will. All the scriptures are based on this fact and advise directing the free will in the right channel. Unquote. In the affairs of actual life, one who has not realized anatta has to go by appearances, and it makes practically no difference whether he believes in predestination or not. For since, in either case, he does not know what is predestined, he has to make decisions and use his initiative, and he acts according to his nature in doing so. Any attempt to limit one's conduct on the pretext of predestination would involve the presumptuous and patently untrue corollary that one knows what is predestined. For instance, suppose you are sitting on the bank of a river when a child falls into the water. To say, if it is its destiny to drown, let it drown, would be a presumptuous supposition that is its destiny. All that you know up to the moment of speaking is that it is the child's destiny to fall into the water within reach of an adult, yourself, who is capable of rescuing it. Since what is to happen is bound up with your own decisions, it makes no practical difference to you whether these do not yet exist or are simply not yet known to you. In either case, you have to make them in ignorance of the outcome. Bhagavan deprecated useless theory. In admitting the appearance of free will in the quotation given above, he interpreted as the importance of turning the apparent free will in the right direction. Similarly, in admitting that actions were predetermined, he turned that also to the need for right effort. Quote, all the activities that the body is to go through are determined when it first comes into existence. It does not rest with you to accept or reject them. The only freedom you have is to turn your mind inwards and to renounce activities there. Unquote. Freedom to turn the mind inwards implies freedom to accept or recognize one's natural state of realization. This invites the question so often asked whether the realized man also is subject to destiny. There is a traditional saying in this connection that if you shoot an arrow at a running deer And by the time it reaches its mark, the deer has already moved away from the spot, and another animal come there, the arrow will pierce the other animal. The implication is supposed to be that if a man creates karma and then turns into a realized man, the karma speeding like an arrow to its mark will strike the realized man, so he also must be considered subject to past karma, that is, to destiny. But the example is not apt. On realizing one's true self, one does not change into a different being, but simply realizes that one is not a being at all, but simply being. One attains freedom from identification with this or any other body-mind complex. The speeding arrow of karma may hit the body, but one is not the body. The body is subject to karma, but the pure being of one's self is not. Suppose a man has a vision of a past incarnation and sees himself a prosperous merchant whose only son is a waster and will ruin the business if it is handed over to him. He sees the situation with as much sympathy as he would a film on a screen, but with no sense of personal involvement. It is not he who is wealthy or distressed or disappointed. Even in this lifetime, an elderly man looking back may see his failures and successes, triumphs and follies of 30 years ago with an equal eye, free from emotion. Similarly, a realized man sees repercussions that could be called destiny overtaking the body that he occupies, but it does not occur to him that they concern him, and therefore he feels no emotion toward them. His body is subject to destiny, but he is not. Therefore, when asked about destiny, Bhagavan would sometimes turn the inert question into a dynamic one by telling you first to find out who it is that has free will or predestination, because that is putting you on the trail of anatta, no ego. Quote, find out who it is who has free will or predestination, and abide in that state. Then both are transcended. That is the only purpose in discussing these questions. To whom do such questions present themselves? Discover that and be at peace, unquote. Since that is the only purpose of such discussion, we will end our discussion here. Here's a poem translated by Father Thomas Merton. The man with one foot and the marsh peasant, or the marsh pheasant.
Pheasant.
Which are from China, you know that. They're imported to North America. You must have them up.
I did not know that.
Yeah. The ring-necked pheasant.
Pheasant.
I used to feed 13 of them in the ashram in Nova Scotia during the winter. I would buy chicken scraps. We used to come to the bird feeder. A big bag of like 50 pounds of chicken scratch.
Oh, goodness.
By Chung Zhu. Kang Wen Sen saw a maimed official whose left foot had been cut off, a penalty in the political game. What kind of man, he cried, is this one-footed oddity? How did he get that way? Shall we say man did this or heaven? Unquote. Heaven, he said. This comes from heaven, not from man. When heaven gave this man life, it willed he should stand out from others and sent him into politics to get himself distinguished. See, one foot. This man is different. The little marsh pheasant must hop 10 times to get a bite of grain. She must run 100 steps before she takes a sip of water. Yet she does not ask to be kept in a hen run. Though she might have all she desired set before her, she would rather run and seek her own little living uncased. That's it. So, commentary? So, Bhagavan Sri Ramana on destiny. The theory that the Maharshi taught was intended only to serve as a basis for practice. However, the demand for practice brought in another branch of theory, that of free will and predestination, since there were not lacking people who asked why they should make any effort if everything is predestined, or if all men return to their source in any case. Question. Shankara says that we are all free, not bound, and that we shall all return to God from whom we came, like sparks from the fire. If that is so, why should we not commit all sorts of sins? Answer, Maharshi. It is true that we are not bound. That is to say, the real self has no bondage. And it is true that you will eventually return to your source. But meanwhile, if you commit sins, as you call them, you have to face the consequences. You cannot escape them. If a man beats you, can you say, I am free, I am not affected by the beating, and feel no pain? Let him continue the beating. If you can really feel that, then you can do what you like. But what is the use of just saying in words that you are free? Bhagavan did sometimes make pronouncements which seemed superficially like affirmations of complete predestination. Bhagavan, all the activities that the body is to go through are determined when it first comes into existence. It does not rest with you to accept or reject them. The only freedom you have is to turn your mind inward and renounce activities there. Question. Are only the important events in man's life, such as his main occupation or profession, predetermined? Or are trifling acts also, such as his taking a cup of water or moving from one part of the room to another? Maharshi, everything is predetermined. Question. Then what responsibility, what free will has man? Maharshi, why does the body come into existence? It is designed for the various things that are marked out for it in this life. As for freedom, a man is always free not to identify himself with the body and not be affected by the pleasures and pains consequent on its activities. Question. Has man any free will, or is everything in life predetermined? No. The same question as above, but the answer differs according to the needs of the questioner. In fact, if one does not bear in mind what had just been said about the unreality of the ego, it seems to be quite contradictory. Maharshi, free will exists together with the individuality. As long as the individuality lasts, so long is there free will. All the scriptures are based on this fact and advise directing the free will in the right channel. Note, is this really a contradiction of the reply given earlier? No, because according to Bhagavan's teachings, the individuality has only an illusory existence. So long as one imagines that one has a separate individuality, so long does one also imagine its free will. The two exist together inevitably. In truth, the ego has no free will, because there is no ego. But on the level of apparent reality, the ego consists of free will. It is the illusion of the one that creates the illusion of the other. That is what Bhagavan meant by saying, as long as the individuality lasts, so long is there free will. The next sentence in his answer turns the questioner away from theory to practice. Find out who it is who has free will or predestination, and abide in that state, then both are transcended. That is the only purpose of discussing these questions. To whom do such questions present themselves? Discover that and be at peace. also Bhagavan, we are all really Satchitananda, being consciousness bliss. But we imagine that we are bound by destiny and have all this suffering. Question, why do we imagine this? Why does this state of ignorance come over us? Bhagavan, ask yourself to whom this ignorance has come, and you will discover that it never came to you, and that you always have been Satchitananda. One goes through all sorts of austerities to become what one already is. All effort is simply to get rid of the mistaken impression that one is limited and bound by the woes of samsara, this life. Question. If what is destined to happen will happen, is there any use in prayer or effort, or should we just remain idle? No, this is a concise form of the question what Bhagavan was so often asked. And the reply is typical, in that it does not expound theory, but prescribes what to do. Bhagavan. There are only two ways in which to conquer destiny or be independent of it. One is to inquire who undergoes this destiny and discover that only the ego is bound by it and that the ego is non-existent. The other way is to kill the ego by completely surrendering to the Lord, by realizing one's helplessness and saying all the time, not I, but thou, O my Lord, and giving up all sense of I and mine and leaving it to the Lord to do what he likes with you. Surrender can never be complete so long as the devotee wants this or that from the Lord. True surrender is love of God for the sake of love and for nothing else, not even for the sake of salvation. In other words, complete effacement of the ego is necessary to conquer destiny of the ego, or it is necessary to conquer destiny, whether you achieve this effacement through self-inquiry or through bhakti marga. Question. Jai Krishnamurti teaches the method of effortless and choiceless awareness as distinct from that of deliberate concentration. Would Sri Bhagavan be pleased to explain how best to practice meditation and what form the object of meditation should take? Bhagavan, effortless and choiceless awareness is our true nature. If we can attain that state and abide in it, that is all right. But one cannot reach it without effort, the effort of deliberate meditation. All the age-old vasanas, inherent tendencies, turn the mind outwards to external objects. All such thoughts have to be given up, and the mind turn inwards, and that, for most people, requires effort. Of course, every teacher and every book tells the aspirant to keep quiet, but it is not easy to do so. That is why all this effort is necessary. Even if we find somebody who has achieved the supreme state of stillness, you may take it that the necessary effort had already been made in a previous life. So effortless and choiceless awareness is attained only after deliberate meditation. That meditation can take whatever form most appeals to you. See what helps you to keep out all other thoughts and adopt that for your meditation. In this connection, Bhagavan quoted some verses from a great Tamil poet and saint, Thayumalavar, the gist of which is as follows. Bliss will ensue if you keep still. But however much you tell your mind this truth, it will not keep still. It is the mind that tells the mind to be still, and it will attain bliss. But it will not do so, though all the scriptures have said it, and though we hear it daily from the great ones, and even from our guru. We are never quiet, but stray into the world of Maya and sense objects. That is why conscious, deliberate effort is needed to attain that effortless state of stillness. Note, Indeed, until the supreme effortless state is attained, it is impossible for a man not to make effort. His own nature compels him to, just as Sri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita told Arjuna that his own nature would compel him to fight. Question: should I try to make no effort at all?
Make the effort to make no effort.
That's what it sounds like.
Is there any way out?
You know, some of the teachers, they say you're making effort that obstructs the realization. So you should just stop all effort and be. So easy to say. And they prescribe no effort. And so they may, people like these teachings very much.
Yeah.
They get big crowds. Question: should I try to make no effort at all? Answer: now it is impossible for you to be without effort. When you go deeper, it is impossible for you to make effort. If you can keep still without engaging in any other pursuits, well and good. But if that cannot be done, what is the use of remaining inactive only with regard to realization? So long as you are obliged to be active, do not give up the attempt to realize the self. Meditation is a fight. As soon as you begin meditation, other thoughts will crowd together, gather force, and try to overwhelm the single thought to which you try to hold. This thought must gradually gain strength by repeated practice. When it has grown strong, the other thoughts will be put to flight. This is the battle always going on in meditation. So long as ego lasts, effort is necessary. When the ego ceases to exist, actions become spontaneous. No one succeeds without effort. Mind control is not your birthright. The few who succeed owe it to their perseverance. Note: sometimes the question took the form of apparent conflict, not between effort and destiny, but between effort and grace. For there were those who asked what use effort was if realization was dependent on the grace of God or Guru. Really, as the following quotation shows, there is no conflict between the two. Question: it is said that only those who are chosen for realization obtain it. That is rather discouraging. Maharshi: that only means that we cannot attain realization of the self by our own mind, unaided by God's grace. Question: is grace necessary for the removal of ignorance? Maharshi: certainly, but grace is always there. Grace is the self. It is not something to be acquired. All that is necessary is to know its existence. In the same way, the sun is pure brightness. It does not know darkness, although others speak of darkness fleeing away on its approach. Like darkness, ignorance is a phantom, not real. Because of its unreality, it is said to be removed when its unreality is discovered. The sun is there and shines, and you are surrounded by sunlight. Still, if you would know the sun, you must turn your eyes in this direction and look at it. Similarly, grace is only to be found by effort. Although it is here and now, one may not be quite sure of God's grace, was the question. Answer: if the unripe mind does not feel God's grace, it does not mean that this is absent, for that would imply that God is at times not gracious, that is to say, ceases to be God. Question: the Upanishads say, I am told, that he alone knows the Atman, whom the Atman chooses. Why should the Atman choose at all? If it chooses, why some particular person? Maharshi: when the sun rises, some buds blossom, not all. Do you blame the sun for that? At the same time, the bud cannot blossom of itself. It requires the sunlight to enable it to do so. Question: if the Supreme Being is omnipresent, as he is said to be, his realization ought to be easy thing. The scriptures, however, declare that without his grace, the Lord cannot even be worshipped, much less realized. So then how can the individual, by his own effort, realize the self or the Supreme Being except through his grace? Maharshi, there was never a time when the Supreme Being was unknown or unrealized, because he is one and identical with the self. His grace, or anugraha, is the same as the conscious immediacy of his divine presence, or prasannata. In other words, enlightenment or realization. One's ignorance of the self, of this self-revealing immediacy of divine grace is no proof to the contrary. If the owl does not see the sun that illumines the whole world, is that the fault of the sun? It is not due to the defectiveness. Is it not due to the defectiveness of the bird's sight? Similarly, if the ignorant man is unaware of the ever-luminous Atman or self, can that be attributed to the nature of the Atman itself? Is it not the result of his own ignorance? The Supreme Lord is eternal grace, and being ever-present, the manifestation of grace is not confined to any particular period or occasion. Grace is not something outside you. In fact, your very desire for grace is due to grace that is already working in you. Question: isn't success dependent on the grace of the Guru? Maharshi: yes, but isn't your practice itself due to such grace? Its fruits spring from it automatically. There is a stanza in Kaivalya Navanita which runs, O Guru, you have always been with me, watching over me, one incarnation after another, and have shaped my course until I was liberated. Unquote. The self manifests externally as a guru when occasion demands, otherwise he always remains within, doing what is required. In actual practice, question, I find that I cannot succeed in my efforts unless Bhagavan's grace descends on me. Maharshi, the Guru's grace is always there. You imagine it to be something somewhere high up in the sky that has to descend. But really, it is inside you, in your heart. And the moment you affect the subsidence or merging of the mind into its source, the grace rushes forth, sprouting as from a spring within you. 40 verses on reality, verse number 19. Only those who have no knowledge of the source of destiny and free will will dispute which of them prevails. They that know the self as the one source of destiny and free will are free from both. Will they again get entangled in them? And finally, a quote from Jalaluddin Rumi. If you are wounded by a thorn, you yourself have sown it. If you are clad in silk and satin, you yourself have woven it.
Mm-hmm. Can we hear that one again, please?
Okay.
If you...
What's this, the last sentence?
Yeah, the Rumi thing.
The last part.
If you are wounded by a thorn, you yourself have sown it. If you are clad in silk and satin, you yourself have woven it.
Mm-hmm. Very nice.
So what time is your flight?
6 o'clock in the evening.
From?
JetBlue, yeah. JFK.
Oh, it's going to be a big crowd. You know that. Massive crowd.
I already checked it.
But do you have a TCA pre-check?
Yeah.
Half the people have it now. When you go to that JetBlue,
yeah,
the lines are both the same.
It's true. I think I'll go early because I think it's going to start raining at 2 o'clock.
Oh.
Yeah. Very early.
Yeah, you have to go early.
Yeah.
They say it's the crowdedest day of the year today,
yes.
The airport, and on the road.
People are stuck in the airport in Denver.
Yeah, the snow.
Oh, go in a wheelchair, Molly.
Huh?
Say you need a wheelchair.
Do you take a wheelchair?
I used to. I don't Maybe I should.
You should, because it's a lot of walking, and also you don't have standing lines.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I can take my surgical note. And
but you know, the thing is, you walk up to the guy and say, "I need a wheelchair." Congruous, you know. Yeah. I mean, like, I can't walk.
Well, you can't walk long distances, maybe.
Weren't you that the roads were so crowded?
What?
There's so much traffic.
Yeah, there is traffic.
Already?
A lot, yes.
Going out of New York, there is traffic.
Right now?
No, in the yesterday.
Oh, yesterday, yeah. Yesterday. Mm-hmm.
We had coming into the city. We used Siri, you know.
Oh.
She took us across the Tappan Zee and then all these local streets in the Bronx and then down across the Throg's Neck.
Mm. Yeah, probably to avoid.
We just did whatever
avoid,
Siri
yeah.
said and we got here.
Yeah.
Oh, when coming back, I don't know, the other time also we got into Bronx, right? One exit
yeah, we took
there
around.
Is a problem.
You know what the sign... Coming down the Hutchinson Parkway, they changed something.
Yeah.
The sign
we
is like something
Bronx.
Like car coming down Hutchinson Parkway. It took us over to 87.
We were on the sawmill, 87.
Yeah,
that's that was it, 87.
Well, that sawmill is different than 87, but it goes on 87.
Do you remember years ago we went to a Russian Orthodox monastery up in the Bronx? I remember those highways. I remember that because we were on those highways. Mm. Remember doing that, Margo? With Bhagavat? And Philip Yanofsky?
Well, Philip took us there somewhere,
yeah.
I think, was it like an art gallery also, or?
I don't remember that.
They
I
had art pieces.
The library.
Philip was trying to get us to have culture.
Yeah.
And Bhagavat only wanted to go to the ocean. Ocean, ocean, ocean. What's there? It's just the ocean. Need some culture.
I was telling Christine about Philip. If he heard there was a holy man, we'd be there.